Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome to Path Through the Program, a 10-part survey of various aspects of the AA program with a couple of different formats designed to appeal to both AAs and Al-Anons, or indeed anyone using the 12 steps. We're ordinary members of the fellowship, and we don't speak for AA or Al-Anon. We hope you find our experience helpful. The format of this session is as follows. Alan and I will speak between us for about half an hour on a topic. As we are speaking, you're encouraged to write any questions you have on slips of paper. Paper and pens will be distributed. Our assistants, Alistair and John, will collect these during the meeting. We will then select questions and, if we can, address them by sharing our experience. The session will last 50 minutes in total. The session is being recorded. Recordings will be made available online over the next few days at a member's personal blog site, which is not affiliated with AA. The QR code and site address are available here on the front table. Let's start with a few moments of silent prayer to use as you wish. This session's topic is We Will Know Peace, and Alan is going to kick us off.
Thank you, Tim. I'm Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Alan.
I'm very glad to be here. I have to stand close to the recording devices. So, as I'm sure you know, this comes from We Will Comprehend the Word Serenity, and We Will Know Peace as part of the promises. And being an alcoholic, I'd like to share with you not only how to do this, but also how not to do it. I'm much, much more accomplished at how not to do this than how to do it, but I'll share both of them with you. In the 12 and 12, in step four, it says, whenever a human being becomes a battleground for the instincts, there can be no peace. And so I thought, could I search through my past to see if I've ever been a battleground for the instincts, and I had a rich seam to tap. So I'm just going to tell you a little about one experience I had being a battleground for the instincts. I was asked to do, it's a while ago, I was asked to do a really delicious piece of work, very easy, very well paid, quite enjoyable. And it was the first bit of freelance work. I've been an employee for a long time. It was the first bit of freelance work that I'd ever been offered. So I started off by being very grateful that I'd been offered this. And then I tapped into my selfishness and my greed. And I thought, I know how I could make this even more remunerative. And I became absolutely determined and obsessed with the idea of not paying tax. Money. And it was pre-internet, but there were bookshops, and I think I can safely say that in the time between being offered the assignment and executing it, or even actually receiving the money, I don't think I passed the bookshop without going in and looking for the finance section to see if I could find something under tax dodges or something similar. And if I woke up at 3 or 4 in the morning, then I'd think about tax dodges. And often during the day, I'd think about tax dodges. And so I spent a considerable amount of time thinking about tax dodges. And I did not know peace. I did not know peace. I was very troubled by it all. And it was for nothing. The wonderful man who offered me this piece of work, he took the precaution of deducting the tax and sending it to Revenue and Customs to save me the trouble of cheating them. And that's kind of a lesson to me about, you know, that is how not to live. That's how not to live. It wasn't a pleasant experience being obsessed, if you can relate to that, being obsessed with this idea, determined to get my own will, just like page 62 of the book, you know, Self Will Run Riot. So I decided that I'd Google this and see, well, what does it say about serenity and peace? And it said, a way of living which includes behavioural, and cognitive components that are associated with feeling calm and untroubled. Calm and untroubled. And it does say, we will comprehend, I mean, this is the promises, after all, it says, we will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. We will, it's a guarantee, we will know peace. It doesn't say that we'll live in a perpetual Zen-like state in harmony with the universe without any trouble, you know. But it does say that we will know it. And so then I ask myself the question, well, how will we know? How will we know peace? Well, it's part of the promises. And so it says, you know, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, which is in step 9. So one interpretation of that would be to say that phase of our development is step 9. So if we're painstaking about step 9, then we will know peace. Not permanently or constantly, but we will know peace. Another interpretation of this phase of our development might be to say the first 9 steps. That phase of our development, the clearing away of the wreckage of the past. If we're painstaking about that, then we will know peace. And it says in step 10 in the 12 and 12, it says, when our inventory is taken and we have made peace with ourselves, when our inventory is taken, we've made peace with ourselves. I once shared with a friend of mine, a good friend of mine in recovery, and you can tell that he loves me by what he said to me when I shared this to him. I shared with him that I'd been involved in a project in AA, organising a retreat with 3 others in AA, and they behaved very badly. They behaved very badly. And they knew that they behaved very badly, and in an ideal world, I would have left it at that. But I didn't leave it at that. I decided that it was my job to point out to them that they had behaved very badly. And when I was sharing this with my good friend, he said to me, well, of course, he said, nobody likes to have their mates mugged off, so let's leave them aside. He said, have you done a step 10 on this? And I rather smugly said to him, yes, I do. Step 10 every day. And he said, have you made amends to them? And I went into a long, elaborate explanation of why it would be a good idea to make amends to them in 2 or 3 months' time. And he said to me, God bless him, he said to me, shall we change that bit of the big book which says, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, to when we were wrong, eventually admitted it? And I wanted to say to him, generally speaking, no. But in this particular case... But I didn't do that. And when it says also, so we've made peace with ourselves, which suggests this battle, this inner conflict that's going on. And it reminds me of something that Novak Djokovic, if I was writing for The Economist, I would say, comma, a tennis player. Something that Novak Djokovic once said when he was interviewed after a match, and he was being... in the usual way, he was being very complimentary about his poor opponent who thrashed, and said very nice things about his opponent. And then he said, and I was intrigued by this, although it's not really surprising, he said, but of course, the real battle, as always, was with myself. And of course, that's my experience as well, is that the real battle, no problems of our own making and all that, the real battle is with myself. I'm going to finish by telling you a story about that. I was invited to do an amazing piece of work in 2019 as part of a job I had at London Region. I was asked to build the website that became aalondon.com. And my first reaction to that, because I'm an alcoholic, was there's absolutely no way I'm doing that. That wasn't part of the job description. But once I got over myself and got on with the task, to my astonishment, this wonderful team of much more talented people seemed to emerge. And it really was a peaceful experience. Everything went brilliantly. And then the pandemic happened, and we had lots of Zoom meetings on the site, and the developer did a great job. You can get into an online meeting in two clicks. Got wonderful feedback from people saying, I'm not technical, but I can use your website. Great. And being used in nearly 100 countries. Everything about it was amazing. And it was a calm, peaceful, serene experience. And it was a joy to be part of this group that I desperately didn't want to be part of. And this is where the problems of our own making and the battle with ourselves comes in. Then I decided, part of that job involved me going up to York once a year. And I then decided, you know that bit in the Big Book that says, cease fighting everything? I decided to ignore that and to charge into York and admonish them for the £100,000 they'd spent on what somebody once described as a clusterfuck of a website. £100,000, and 88% of the traffic to the website is looking for a meeting, unsurprisingly. And I said, I boasted to them that we'd built a better meeting finder in London for £400. And they could have it, we'd share the code with them. And I got absolutely nowhere. I just created for myself an unpeaceful existence. And in fact, I asked a man who's not sitting far from us to share his experience of dealing with York.
We're being recorded.
I'll only share the first part,
too. Okay.
and the first part of it was, quote, wave the white flag in surrender. Wave the white flag in surrender. And I'm happy to tell you today that that is advice that I'm taking. Because it isn't about websites and all that kind of stuff. It's about staying sober and carrying the message. And it's also about living peacefully. It's very well written in the book, Big Book, when it says that there are certain things, I'm paraphrasing here, that are best left to people who are better able to handle. Things like self-righteous anger, getting on your hobby horse, riding up to York and saying, why don't you use our meeting finder? That kind of stuff. That's not good for me. That's not good for me. Because I lose sight of what this is about. I then think it becomes about 21st century websites. And it's not about 21st century websites. It's about being kind and useful and peaceful. And I'm going to leave it there.
My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Also a member of Al-Anon. So it talks in step nine. That's where we got this phrase from. We will know peace. And what I can't do is say, well, I'm going to be at peace and snap my fingers and discover myself at peace. The reason I'm not at peace under any conditions is that I have a disturbance. So peace is what's left over when the disturbance is removed. And I came to AA... Well, before I ever drank, I was incredibly disturbed. And I was seen to by a lot of very, very good professionals. They were top-notch, but it talks in the Big Book about cases of alcoholism which don't respond to other forms of treatment, other forms of other interventions. And I was someone whose problems generally did not respond to any other interventions. And I was talking to someone earlier about this today. So how do you get to peace? You get to peace by getting rid of the disturbance. How do you get rid of the disturbance then becomes the question. And I remember going into a session with a professional. I just joined AA, and someone marched up to me in a meeting. If you're very disturbed and very vocal about it and new in AA and disrupt meetings and cause trouble, people will queue up afterwards to tell you what to do to sort out your problem. And someone queued up very politely with all the others and said, "Sonny Jim, if you don't sort out your family of origin issues, you're not going to stay sober." So I dutifully went off to find someone to help me. And I walked in because I thought, well, my family are a bit peculiar, but there's no real problem there that you know, maybe a few sessions can't solve. And what the session did very expertly was started to open my eyes to the full horror of my childhood and the interrelation between my parents and the upbringing and the state I found myself in at the age of 21 when I was new. So it was as though I went into the session with one problem to talk about on the list of 12 or 13 problems. I had one problem, and I came out and I came out with a baker's dozen of problems, which I then had to go through the rest of the week carrying in my little problem basket, holding them intact until I was at the next session. Now, in a sense, what they were doing was very good because it opened my eyes, but I couldn't handle what my eyes were being opened to. What AA does for people like that approach, I'm not saying it's a bad approach, but it wasn't the right approach to me because I was so unstable. I couldn't handle the things that I was learning, and the solution bit, which would have been way down the track. I didn't have time to hang around to wait for that. I was operating on a schedule here. If I didn't get some kind of peace very soon, I was in serious trouble. And I got a sponsor who was several notches smarter than me, which was very helpful because I was outmaneuvered. Whatever I threw at him, I was outmaneuvered. And I was just told to get on with the steps very, very quickly. The level of instability, I found it so difficult writing my step four because of what it was bringing up that often, in order to face it, I would go round to his... he would let me go round to his flat, and I had to sit... I couldn't sit on... I had to sit on the floor because I didn't feel safe on chairs when I was looking at this. So I sat on the floor in the corner. Once there was a knock on... I was writing my step four. I was a few weeks sober. I was writing my step four, and there was a knock on the door. And my sponsor, who was sort of tall and American with lots and lots of teeth, opened the door, and lots of Americans who were tall and had lots of teeth and, you know, the sort of Colgate glint, and they all looked like, you know, college football players. They marched in, they're all talking away. And one of them looked over and realised there was this creature in the corner writing its step four. And they said, "What is that?" And my sponsor said, "Oh, that's Princess Parfait. She does everything she's told. She's doing her step four." I carried on writing. Anyway, that's by the by, really. But the point is that I did a step four, and I shared. I think I had just a few pages, maybe 7 or 8 pages of material, and I shared it with him. And a very curious thing happened. First of all, I'd eliminated all of the secrets of any significance in 7 or 8 pages. Point one, there are 3 elements to arriving at peace, I think. The first one is eliminating the secrets. The secrets are what suggest to me that I'm fundamentally different from you and there is something wrong with me. When there may be something wrong with you, but you've got a different thing wrong with you. You've got your own weird secret shit. I've got mine, and mine separates me from you. And I called my ego's bluff by getting the whole lot out in somewhere between 1 and 2 hours. And I noticed that my sponsor was nonplussed by my step four. There was no reaction at all. There was no discussion. He was just, okay, are you hungry? I said, yes. He said, pizza. I said, yes. He said, I'll order a pizza. And we ordered a pizza. That was it. I got cute at that point and said, do I have any character assets? And he said, because I'd heard someone saying to balance up the low self-worth that might be induced by writing and talking about your defects, that one should write about the assets, so that if you had enough assets, they would somehow outweigh the defects and you'd come out ahead. I think that's the theory of it. I said, do I have any assets? He said, just one. And I said, what's that? He said, a willingness to change. And you see, what is presented in some quarters as being devastating to the sense of self-esteem and ego, which is this rehashing of one's wrongs, of one's character defects, the actual practice of it is counterintuitive. What it did, it restored a sense of self-esteem. It restored a sense of intact identity, because it was very clear from his reaction to me that everything that I'd said was not me. It was what I'd thought, it was what I'd done, it was where I'd been, it was what had happened to me. I was not the character defects, but I had to talk about them, to put them over there, to put them in words. And this is the interesting thing, to be able to walk all the way around and come back to the starting point and realize, you mean the whole catastrophe of the last few years, which rendered me in a state where I would sit in the middle of busy roads hoping to get struck by a vehicle so that I would die but not be blamed for it because it couldn't be suicide, it was clearly an accident, that whatever had induced me to do that could be walked around in an hour. Maybe the problem wasn't as big as I thought it was, and I relaxed. Second thing that happened during the course of this, we didn't formally talk about forgiveness in any in-depth or elaborate sense. We've got a session on forgiveness this afternoon. It's the one immediately after this one. And that's when you can practice forgiving us for anything that we have said in the last few minutes, or maybe about to say in answer to your questions. Doug and I didn't talk about forgiveness per se. But he just said very simply, these people on your step four that you resent, they've got their own problems too, just like you. And that simple line was enough. It was like opening a trap door and all of the grievance fell through it to the other side. The third thing was... So the first thing is getting rid of the secrets. The second thing is getting rid of the grievances by seeing myself on a level playing field with other people, encumbered with the same difficulties, essentially, as other people. Fear and everything that comes from fear, because that's what everything, I think, comes from. The third thing was the amends, the harms that I'd done others. And some... rotten things happened to me during my childhood, some of which I responded to with very public retaliation. And I made amends to the people against whom I retaliated. Now, in those situations, my fault may have been a small fragment of the overall picture, but that small fault was my fault and needed to be dealt with. It's not to condone anything that happened to me, because that's their business. That's between them and their higher power. But once I disregard other people, my harm is what is left over. And the amazing thing about the amends, when you listen to speaker tapes, very often there are these... One of the sort of standard formats for doing a podium pitch at conventions, when you get to the recovery bit... for the last 20 minutes or so. There'll be two or three stories about these like amazing amends moments where, you know, I was at my father's deathbed, or I was reunited with my long lost second cousin, or whatever it was. These are coincidences and God shots and all these amazing things where everything comes together, like one of those sort of Channel 5 or Hallmark Channel films. My amends in my first year were everything, in a sense, everything went wrong. I thought that I was going to make amends to people. They'd be, oh, we're so pleased and let's be friends again. No one wanted to be friends again with me after I'd made amends. They were, thanks very much, very good. Bye-bye. But it was perfect because I looked at myself after those amends and said to myself, there is literally nothing more I can do. So those are now crossed off the list. Who's available now? What's next? And that sense of unfinished business, I thought the disturbance was all sorts of other things, and it wasn't. It was had three sources. Number one, the secrets. Number two, grievances. Number three, unfinished amends. And if I'm disturbed today, those are the three questions I have to ask myself. What am I keeping to myself? Who haven't I forgiven? In other words, who are the people who I've judged where I need to remove the judgment? And who do I need to make amends to, or who do I need to alter my behaviour towards? And I've discovered peace is my natural state. And if I remove the obstacles to peace, boom, peace will just show up automatically. And I'm just going to, I know there's a whole session on forgiveness, but I want to say one thing about it. I don't think forgiveness is even about understanding other people and why they do what they do. I think that may be, it's a useful exercise in itself. But it struck me the other day, there was a particular situation where I worked myself up into a lather and then discovered I needed to forgive, which meant that I needed to withdraw the judgment. And what I realised is that whatever was going on out, whatever these people were doing, I built the resentment from scratch. I built the grievance from scratch within my own mind. My grievance had nothing to do with the person who appeared to occasion or elicit it. It was a structure that I built inside my own mind, and I needed to debuild it within my own mind. Not, I'm going to retain my negative judgment of this bunch of people, but ask God to help me slather on this kind of whipped cream, sugary, oh, well, I forgive you because you did the best you could in the circumstances. And that's like when, you know, teenagers, they don't have a bath, they just spray Lynx over the top, thinking that, you know, everything is going to smell amazing now. And now you've got two bad smells in the room, not one, no offence to anyone that is wearing Lynx today. So forgiveness, it doesn't involve, it's not about the other person, because the resentment has got nothing to do with them. The resentment is because there is something in me that feels guilty. And to hide my guilt, I need to find someone else that's guilty. So I look around and just, and when my eye lands on someone who has committed what I think is a sin, well, they'll do. And then I work myself up. So it never had anything to do with them anyway. But I'm able, I'm sure you're able to read the newspaper and read all sorts of ills in the world. And you think, oh, turn the page, read the next one. And then there'll be one which catches your eye. Why that one? Is that morally worse than the others? What? And you watch TV programs where people do the most appalling things without a flicker of grievance at the immorality of what is presented. So my disturbance is all to do with me. It's never anything to do with the actual situation. The situation is the pretext. The situation is the white wall onto which I'm projecting some kind of internal drama to get the bony finger of blame coming down from heaven, pointing at someone else, not me. I'm finish on this. This is the Al-Anon point. I promised myself I'd make one Al-Anon point here. In One Day at a Time in Al-Anon, which is one of the Al-Anon books, it's my favourite one, page a day, it's enough to be getting along with. It says, if I do what I'm supposed to do, I'll be at peace. And in a sense, they needn't have written anything after that point in Al-Anon, because what that entails is, if I do as I'm supposed to do, that means I'm to refrain from all the things I'm not supposed to do. To do what I'm supposed to do at each point of the day. I get to the end of the day and think not I've had a good day, or nice things have happened to me, or the world has been agreeable. I think to myself, I'm satisfied with how I've conducted myself today. And that is the source of peace in my life. It has nothing to do with the outside. And as C.S. Lewis said, they can have my body, but they can't have my mind. I'm the one that is in charge of whether or not I'm at peace, and it's got entirely to do with my conduct. So that's the end of that. We're going to have some questions and answers now. Oh, good, we've got some. You're up. Can you describe how peace feels for you at the current stage of your recovery, what it was before and what it is now?
How does peace feel? It feels like a warm, pleasant bath, or a walk on the hillside overlooking the sea with a gentle breeze and the sun shining. It feels an unburdening. When I finished my step nine, making my amends in step nine, it removed the feeling that I had that around every corner was somebody that I'd offended, or somebody that I didn't want to see. And as Tim said, I wasn't that important, you know, the problem wasn't that big. And after I'd made my amends, I wasn't frightened of going around the corner. I knew I would run into. I'll pass that over to you.
But this one follows on from it, I think. Is being at peace the same as feeling good? Very good question.
Is being at peace the same as feeling good? Well, being at peace can be the same as feeling good, but I think there are other good feelings other than feeling peaceful. Good is a judgment. So, for example, I would have said, going back to the previous question, once upon a time I would have said to you that a good feeling was excitement. I'm not so sure about that today. Maybe that's, you know, best left to people who are better able to handle it than me. I don't think that being at peace is the same thing as feeling good. I think there are lots of good feelings. There are lots of ways of feeling good. Some chemical, some not.
Another question. I know some people who do assets in step four to help the sponsee's self-esteem. And then there is little talk of gratitude lists, etc., in original texts, though somewhat commonplace. I think they mean somewhat commonplace in meetings. For people to talk about gratitude lists. Do AAs nowadays require more positive reinforcement? I think there's a lot in... I think there are four or five distinct questions in here. I think it's worth discussing this assets question and the self-esteem question. I think it's valid. I will sometimes acknowledge in myself when I'm doing inventory and contextualise by saying, okay, here are some things I'm doing right in this situation, and here are some things I'm doing wrong in this situation. And I find gratitude lists incredibly helpful for reversing my sense of self-pity that everything is going wrong. To make a gratitude list neutralizes that by indicating actually only a fraction of things are going wrong. Most things are going okay. It's only the squeaky wheels whose operation you notice. You don't notice the wheels that are working perfectly well. But this question of self-esteem, I think, is such an important one. And if one goes about it the right way, it can speed up getting to self-esteem. And the last part of this question, do AAs nowadays require more positive reinforcement? I think what's behind that is the idea, well, maybe they don't talk about assets in the big book because people didn't need their self-esteem to be bolstered. Maybe they didn't have gratitude lists because people, again, didn't need the antidote to self-pity, whereas now we're somehow more impaired or more fragile, and so maybe we need this extra help. If one goes back through history and reads back through history, these phenomena of low self-esteem or self-hatred, I mean, you just read St. Augustine's Confessions and you'll discover plenty of evidence that people for quite some time have had a tiny little difficulty with self-image, you know, hardly worth mentioning. So there is an issue there, but I think the solution is in the big book if you're looking for it. If you take a question, this is a very helpful thing that was given to me many years ago. Take your question, go to the big book, read it, and ask God to speak through the text or your understanding of the text to provide the answer. And once I did go through looking for stuff on specifically on self-esteem, and there's a line on page 28, which I won't be able to remember exactly, but something like, if what we have learnt means anything at all, it means that all of us, regardless of our colour, creed or whatever, are children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship on simple and understandable terms. And it's this notion of being children of God. And one can, you know, if one's not religious, one can say children of the universe. And the image was given to me, and some people will know this, so I apologise if this is old information, but when one is out and about, one will often see in London little crowds of school children, little sort of 5 or 6 year olds being ferried to some, I don't know what they're going to see, a giraffe or something. And they're in twos, and they sew their mittens together so that they can't get lost, with these very little bright jerkins, with very large numbers of teachers making sure they don't run into the street or clamber up the walls or something. And you look at these little crocodiles of children, and they're all completely delightful. Their little faces full of sort of awe and joy. And now if someone said to you, which one of those children is worth more than any of the other children, it would be an absolute grotesque thing to ask. One of the great progressive scientific movements of the 20th century was eugenics, which precisely did place a value, a differential value on human beings, to say that this lot is worth more, this lot is worth less. So we'll find ways scientifically of getting rid of the ones who are worth less, stopping them from being born. The AA approach is, no, everyone is of infinite worth. If you come in tradition 3 and you want to stop drinking, we don't care if you smell or vomit or do other, you know, funky stuff during the meeting, as long as you're reasonably quiet about doing it. And even then, it's amazing the tolerance that, you know, we're not picky at all in AA. Pretty much anyone can come in Al-Anon. To be a member of Al-Anon, you have to know someone. You have to know an alcoholic. There's a bit of a requirement, though. AA, let anyone in. And that radical inclusion of everyone, that is the basis for self-esteem. My esteem, thank God, does not go up and down. So if I behave badly, I'm not worth less as a person. and if I behave well, I'm not worth more as a person. This pernicious idea that you get self-esteem by doing esteemable things. So if you get self-esteem from having a job and doing well at the job, what happens when you do shit at the job or you get sacked or you're unemployed? Does that mean you're worth less as a person? Clearly not. It's so dangerous that my self-esteem has to be quite detached from the moral judgment of I've done something wrong. Now, if I do something wrong, I rightly feel guilt. If I don't feel guilt doing something wrong, there's something wrong with me. I'm disassociated from the moral consequences of my behaviour. But the problem is where guilt swills across into the self-esteem compartment, because the bulkhead is not secure, and my whole perception of myself as a person gets altered because of the thing that I've done. So I think it's quite right. People, and I do find people very fragile, the newcomers, I frankly, I do find people far more fragile than my memory. Maybe my memory is wrong. But the answer there is to build up the person's sense of self as being valuable simply because they exist, not tying it to anything else. And the fact of loving someone, giving them your time, that was what convinced me I was worth it. Not people, because people have been buttering me up during my childhood. So, you know, we love you very much and blah, blah, blah. And it was all a manipulation. But people in AA who gave me their time, even though I could give nothing to them, that proved to me that they thought there was someone worthwhile buried below the layers of shit that was worth fostering to become a full human being. And that was what got rid of my low self-esteem. It wasn't any of the surface tricks. I've talked a lot there. Can you...
Yes, just briefly, on the same note, when I talk to my sponsor, who's a busy man, he gives the impression that he has all the time in the world for me, and that I'm making his day by talking to him. I mean, having said that, mostly what we're doing is laughing at ourselves. So yeah, and there's a wonderful sense of self-esteem that comes from that. Do we need to build up our assets? I don't think that's the point of step four. We suffer from King Baby Syndrome, you know, big ego, low self-worth. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the place for it. That's my experience. I'll leave it there.
Can you talk about your experience with equanimity, how to stay at peace while emotional disturbance happens?
I could just say that I find that very difficult, you know, that a very, very small thing can happen to me. Like a message. I mean, recently I got a text message, and I dealt with it. I considered I dealt with it in an adult way, and the following morning I woke up and I was volcanic with rage, absolutely volcanic, and it took me. I'd say it took me a good 24 hours. To process that. And I have to share with you, for me, that's amazing. That is really amazing, because I could have something like that and it could take up months. It could take up months of my life. Particularly if I didn't handle it in an adult way. And my first reaction, I remember sending, I'll stand up so you can see this at the back. I sent an email to somebody on a laptop, and after I sent the email, I went... So I may not be the best person to talk about equanimity. And of course, I had to make amends for the email that I sent. So I think it needs to be dealt with before. When I have a strong feeling, and what I did on the occasion that I was talking to you about, where I managed it in 24 hours. I talked to a few people to try and get some sort of perspective about it. And I remind myself that it's a feeling. It's a feeling. But it's very easy for me to say it's just a feeling if you're having it, you know, if I'm having it.
like somebody once said, the difference between a recession and a depression. It's a recession when you lose your job. When I lose my job, that's a depression. So, just to get a sense of perspective by talking to other people, I think.
What has been the hardest thing you did in your recovery?
The hardest thing I've done in recovery. I defended an action in the High Court. When I say I defended it, I wasn't representing myself. I defended an action, and it took 4 years. My barrister said that either I was the greatest con man he'd ever met, or this was the greatest injustice he'd ever seen. I felt very flattered by that, but actually it was the latter. It was a great injustice. And each day for 4 years, and I don't think I'm exaggerating by saying that each day I said to myself, and had I lost the case, we would have been completely wiped out. And each day for 4 years I said to myself, the only way I can lose is if I pick up a drink. And if we lose, we will live in a smaller house which we won't own. And in the grand scheme of things, the man who 12-stepped me said, it's important if it interferes with your breathing. So in that regard, but it was difficult. It was very difficult. But actually it was a wonderful experience. Wonderful experience. But I would say that was the hardest thing I've done. Because there were all kinds of things I was tempted to do. I remember a conversation I had with my wife where I was explaining to her, I said, I've had this brilliant idea. It's really going to help the case. And the first part of the idea involved breaking into an office. And I was very frustrated with my wife because she wouldn't let me get to the brilliant bit. She was bogged down in the criminality of the early stages of my genius. So there were a lot of things that could have gone wrong in that process. And they didn't because, God was with me. And what struck me about it was that one person, my opponent, was behaving exceedingly badly. But I was surrounded by people who were behaving amazingly and who were incredibly supportive. Not least people in AA, but not just people in AA. So that was the hardest thing.
How do you forgive a loved one when they keep punishing you for your past drinking?
My lovely wife, lovely Lisa, I call her, we've been married for 42 years, and the first five of that I was drinking. And in my mind, there's a line. The day I stopped drinking, and everything that happened before that, in my mind, everything that happened before that, it's a disease, it's like I have a clear conscience about all that. And she doesn't see it like that. To her, we've been married for 42 years, and for some of them I was difficult because I was drinking, and for the other 37, I'm difficult sober. And she doesn't punish me. She's not like that. She doesn't punish me for my drinking, but what she does, occasionally, she'll refer to it. She'll say things like, I wish there had been iPhones around when you were drinking, and I could have video recorded you. But sometimes she'll say things about things that I did when I was drinking, and I can tell you, I really do not want to hear them. I've never wanted to hear them. I don't enjoy hearing them now. And the way that I deal with them is that in the first place, I shut up and I listen, and then I try to say something like, that must have been awful. must have been awful for you. Rather than saying, but I don't drink anymore. I don't drink anymore. I've been sober a long time, you know. So I'm delighted to say there's nobody punishing me for my drinking. Although, actually, when I think about it, the mere mention of it is a punishment, in a way, to me, but it's not much of a punishment. So I deal with it by listening and accepting. I'm responsible for that. I'm responsible for that. I was that person, notwithstanding the disease. I did those things. And my wife is perfectly entitled to bring them up, should she choose, which, mercifully, she doesn't do very often.
I want to come back to this question. Can you describe how peace feels for you at the current stage of your recovery? A condition of peace is not the flatlining that I thought it was. I thought when I was new that being at peace would be just and that's dead. When a country is at peace, it can get on with its stuff without being interfered with by outside forces. And so to be at peace means that I can get on. It's like being inside a huge castle where there are lots of really interesting things happening and there are barbarians outside, but they can't get in because we're very well defended. So we just get on with our shit. We don't care. They can do what they want. There is literally nothing they can do to get inside. That's what peace feels like. One last thing. What's your opinion? Very dangerous question. Word to put in a question. What's your opinion on bringing disturbances to meetings? It makes them sound like little creatures on leashes, which you then release and let them run round. Would you always do a step 10 first and use meetings to carry the message only? So we'll finish on this question.
What's your opinion on bringing disturbances to meetings? You know, some people say carry the message, not the mess, and some people say the mess is the message. Bringing disturbances to meetings. I remember going to a meeting. It was after my mother had died, and I was going to a meeting early one morning. It was dark. It was November, and I had a rolled-up copy. My father was living with me. And I had a rolled up copy of a newspaper, and between the tube station and the meeting, I was beating the buildings. Fortunately, there weren't very many people around. I was beating the buildings with this newspaper. I was so angry, so angry. And I shared at that meeting. There was a chair at the meeting, and I was fine during the chair, and the secretary was sharing back, and I thought, if he doesn't fucking get on with it, I'm going to interrupt him. So I wasn't in a good place, but I managed, mercifully, to wait until the secretary had finished sharing back, and then I vomited out this stuff. And there was an angel sitting next to me at the meeting. My father was from Loch Lomond, and the chap sitting next to me in the meeting was from Loch Lomond, and he took me out for a cup of coffee after the meeting. And what he said to me was, I can't tell you how much you helped me with what you shared, but I don't want to talk about that. He said, I don't want to talk about that. I just want to talk about you and your dad and what's going on. And I thought, God, where can you get a service like that? That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. Literally an angel there. And somebody who's walking, I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. Somebody who's going down the street, beating buildings with a rolled up newspaper is in a bad way. They need help. And I went to a meeting and I got help because I shared. And I can't remember what I said. But it won't have been pretty. And there was somebody there to help me. Maybe somebody saved my life, I don't know. Saved me from drinking. So I would say, fill your boots. As a routine occurrence to go every week, and I think then you need to have a chat with your sponsor. Or have a look at the big book. Or both.
Very good. That's all the time we have, I'm afraid. The remaining sessions today are on forgiveness. That's at 2:30. Applying the program to relationships at 3:30. Applying the program to work at 4:30 and service as a way of life at 5:30. So let's close with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant serenity to accept things I cannot change, courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.